This is a CNA podcast.
Now, there is a saying, cash is king. But, you know, I'm not so sure that still holds true today. I mean, it feels like we live in an almost cashless existence. I used to carry quite a lot of cash in my wallet, but these days I have to admit I enjoy my sleek, light wallet, which actually carries a much greater spending power than I ever could if I carried cash. And for our younger ones today, probably don't even need a wallet. Everything they need is on their mobile phones. Catching a movie, buying food at the hawker center, taking the MRT, just a swipe of a card, a scan of a QR code, a transfer to another mobile phone number. There are multiple digital payment platforms that allow you to spend money way too easily. Super convenient? Well, some might disagree. In our relentless march towards everything digital, are we leaving some segments of the population behind? And what happens when that online payment platform breaks down? Are we left more vulnerable to the likes of scammers and cybercriminals? Hey everyone, it's Stephen Chia, and today on Heart of the Matter, we're discussing the topic of e-payments. How do we cater for these issues and help those who may be slower to adopt them? With me to discuss this are Fei Sai, a young hawker.
Hi everyone.
Lawrence Chan, Group CEO of Nets.
Hello.
Lim Mayan, Director of the Fair Tech Institute at Access Partnership.
Hey everybody.
So welcome guys. Let's start off by talking about the e-payment landscape in Singapore. And Singapore's adoption rate is actually really high for cashless payments. In fact, it's said to be one of the highest in Asia at something like 97% according to data. Lawrence, I gotta say, that's quite a staggering percentage. It sounds really good. And are you surprised by this number, or are you just like, yeah, this is the way it should be?
It's not something that's been overnight for us to reach this level. Like in many other places, it has been quite successful, I think, in terms of going digital. The way I describe it is, it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to raise a new form of payment. It's been a very conscientious effort across the whole ecosystem to make it where we are today.
As a small country, we are pushing towards a lot of the adoption of technology in a very quick way. So I guess that has helped too. Has it changed significantly, the digital payment space? Where has been the most significant change in the last decade, last 5 years?
I don't want to play up the pandemic, and it's definitely had a very negative impact on our lives, on many people's lives. But if there's any silver lining from it, digital payments has benefited from the COVID experience. Prior to the pandemic, I think the resistance or the adoption of digital payment was slower. QR especially as a form factor for payments since the pandemic.
We were forced, I guess, to a certain extent to use more of technology to get on with our lives. So Faye, let me ask you, at your shop, you sell coffee and you take digital payments from your customers, right? Give me some idea, out of every 10 customers, how many of them would pay you in cash?
Out of 10, I think 3 would pay in cash and 7 with QR codes.
Okay.
Yes.
And the 3 that pay you in cash, is it because they don't know how to use the QR codes? They don't have those facilities?
I don't think they don't have them. They carry a mobile phone when they order. I just think the general consensus when they give us cash, and you can see, is that they think it's a hassle to whip the phone out, to scan, and then to key in the price themselves. They find that handing cash and then grabbing the change is a lot faster. We understand because at the hawker center, when you're trying to get your coffee before you go into the office or maybe during your lunch, you want to get it quick and fast. So in their heads, it's embedded that cash, give me change, take my coffee, go.
But I'm just thinking in my mind, actually, from the time I order my coffee, the time you take to make my coffee is more than the time I would need to punch in the numbers in the phone,
right?
It is. Do you ever have some of the older customers who prefer to pay with cash?
The majority of the older customers do still pay with cash, but I'd say 70% of them are not averse to using their phones at all. In fact, a lot of them want to try, but they're so afraid of holding up the queue, forgetting their password, or not having put in a card, or not linking their bank accounts. They're so afraid of that, that they just, aya, no lah, I just use cash lah, faster.
And I think this fear factor is quite real, if I ask Mayan. There is a segment of the population that feels a bit apprehensive about using technology?
I think you're never really very sure when you're an older person. You're still exploring with the new technology. You have some level of confidence in it, but hey, using your fingerprint, wow, that sounds very fantastical to my parents. There is some anxiety about it. And because there is very little assurance, I think that, for example, paying somebody for the coffee and then getting the reassurance that, yes, I have received that money. Sometimes the server, the person receiving the money or receiving the cashless payment, doesn't give enough reassurance that, yes, auntie, uncle, got the money already.
Right. For a moment there, when you said the server, I was thinking of the actual computer server because we're talking about digital payments, you know?
No, no. I think the usual markers of that social nicety of giving you cash, giving you back the change, etc., giving you the receipt, I think those social indicators are slightly missing, especially, Lawrence, I think, in the middle of that digital transaction where you actually cashless, cannot touch you, cannot face you, cannot do anything with you, you know?
In the payment space, we have this phrase called self-suppression. Right? Means,
oh, what does that mean?
It means you suppress the next transaction and you do it by yourself. Suppression meaning you cannot use the payment option that you like to use at the point of sale. You self-suppress because you may be embarrassed the previous time. That experience of being embarrassed the previous time holds you back from wanting to do it again. So the amount of education, the amount of confidence we need to give for any segment to start a new payment option. And this started with cards before as well.
Okay.
But that was so long ago. And it started for tap even, right? So breaking that self-suppression is very important for us to get a deep penetration of usage into the community.
I've never thought of it that way. In the sense that if I try it once and I fail, so to speak, then the next time I'll think twice, right? About using it again, right?
Maybe more so in the Asian context. I feel embarrassed, I feel paisei. Yeah. You know, I have many people waiting behind me. I may do it when there's nobody there and I'm just alone, maybe in an off-peak hour to try again.
So it's not that our older folks don't want to try it. They're just a bit fearful of the possible consequences, holding up other people.
It's the paisei factor. Yeah. I think that's really strong. I think that in Singapore, at least from a research perspective, we do see that the population tends to be a bit more accepting of the fact that we need to change. Mm-hmm. I listed them down. If we're talking about cashless, right? For example, we're moving checks to giro, to credit cards, then we chip-based systems and then the cash card to stored value cards like the EasyLink card, and then now with all of the payments via that. I think that we are very used to a very quick cycle of change, but this paisei factor perhaps is a big factor. It's quite psychological.
And it has to do a bit with, I guess, the pace of life here, because sometimes my friends coming to visit and we buy stuff at the shop and our transaction is so quick. It's a real transaction. There are no niceties, as you're talking about the humanity behind it. No, hi, how are you today? You know, or hi, how's it going? You know, it's like, I'm just a face at the shop. I'm buying my coffee, even though I've been there every day this week. I'm still just another face buying coffee.
That's not true.
I mean, you may remember some people.
I do. But what Mayan has brought up, and with self-suppression as well, it really comes down to the server, and you're right. But we are young, the staff at the stalls are young, and what we advocate, especially when we deal with older customer who's trying to use a cashless payment mode, is to encourage and to teach and to make sure that we tell them, uncle, it's okay, you know, let me show you one time. You do one time, you do second time, the third time, sure, very easy. You just need to do the first time. Unfortunately, we are the rare few stalls, hawker stalls that would do that, but we can afford it. We are educated, we can help. But most times when it's a slam and there's a queue, we're like, uncle, sorry, can you just pay cash? There's a long queue behind you. I really need to make money, you know.
Right,
most times it's like that with other hawkers.
Well, at least you say it nicely. I've had this before where I tried to use an app and something failed and the cashier gave me this look, right? You're like, I'm like, sorry.
Are you sure you have the app?
Yeah, and I both know it's not going to work.
Don't waste my time. I could see it on her face. But this whole idea of going cashless, with a lot of our delivery couriers, they went contactless, you know, during the pandemic. Can it work against us? For instance, not everyone has access to a digital payment platform. My son's 15. He doesn't have his own bank account yet, much less credit cards, right? So he went to a shop, a cafe, wanted to buy a drink, and they told him, sorry, we're cashless. He's like, what do I do with my $5? So literally he had to pay the staff who then use their own payment platform to pay and buy the drink for him. So it kind of does work to a certain extent against us at some point, right?
I think in Singapore, we're really very privileged and we really don't have any population that's unbanked. We maybe have underserved. At the two extremes from an age standpoint, my parents' generation and maybe my younger children generation will be underserved. So yeah, I've got a 14-year-old. We give him Yeah, because I work for Nets, we give him a Nets prepaid card.
Okay.
Right, so a Nets prepaid card at all 100,000 locations, whenever he spends, I can ask the mother, hey, how come he went McDonald's, spent $17? And the mom will say, no, don't get angry.
Maybe are you giving me ideas?
Maybe he bought for his friend, right? So it's a good thing. Don't have to question him straight away. With the Nets prepaid card, the great thing about it is on the app, we can see all the transactions. It's good for us to see. But I think tracking is a great financial...
Right.
Skill that you need to start from.
But some would argue that sometimes it's better to have cash because when you are giving away cash, it hurts more. You know what I mean? I see my $10 go away and I come back, I only have $2. I know I've used 8 and it's gone, right? Whereas with a cashless transaction, it's almost like tap, oh.
Honestly, I have this conversation with my wife. How do we give money to our kids? Do we give money to our kids electronically or do we give money to our kids in person so that they come home, they can say thank you, thanks dad for the money, right? Because I'm biased, I push digital payments at work, I want to push digital payments at home. To me, it's the value is the same. How do we then communicate that value and let the children understand the value is still the same?
It's an interesting viscerality, I think, that is a difference between the older generation and the middle generation and the younger generation. Because I think for the older ones here, when we spend money, we actually feel the tactility of the cash. But I don't think that there has been enough research done on how does the younger generation understand cash. Because to them, it's digits. Do they feel that same quality of receiving and spending money? Because I think they do, but maybe we don't understand it. It's a different feeling. And I don't think that we've done enough research in psychology to understand that in the first instance. But coming back to your point about inclusion, when we talk about cashless payments, when we talk about contactless payments, how about people who are visually impaired, for example? Mm-hmm. How does that impact them? I'm chair for the Board of Engineering Good, and we work a lot with disadvantaged people as well as the disabled. And this is something which I can't reconcile. Like, we want to go cashless, but what about the people we are not including in this pursuit? How can we be inclusive?
And that specific group, because if you can't see what you're doing in this case, then you really can't use these platforms, right?
Well, if you talk about just cash itself already, it's difficult enough for somebody who can't see to pay by cash. But what if you add in contactless? Then forget Braille. You're not supposed to touch anybody. How does that translate?
But then one could also argue that as technology develops, there could be voice recognition, different platforms which allow you to instruct the devices to pay certain exact amounts. I don't know, are we there yet?
Today when a QR payment is made at the hawker, right, the merchant is able to hear from his or her mobile phone the amount that is being paid.
Oh, it'll go ding.
Yes, $1.60 received.
Yeah. Correct.
Oh.
But not so nice lah.
Oh, it's English. Okay. $2.60,
yes,
come
already. Yes, something like that. Yes, exactly.
Yes, we are trying actually to train more and more of our merchants. The moment of truth is not when the customer shows you his or her mobile phone. It's listening to that or checking their own app on their phone to see that the payment is
being made.
But
what about the customer who is may not be able to use that device because they can't see it as clearly?
I personally think whether it's cash or digital, there's the element of trust needed.
Okay.
The great thing about digital is that it's a digital footprint. So with digital footprint, there's more tracking and therefore over time, I would like to think that it's easier to build trust on something that there's a footprint.
But I challenge you there also because when it comes to QR codes, we recently heard of a story where a 60-year-old woman lost about $20,000 because she scanned a bogus QR code. It was outside the bubble tea shop. She thought, download this app, get a $2 discount, whatever, something like that. She did just that. Next thing you know, she's down $20,000. In fact, this is something that could possibly happen to any of us. And looking at a QR code, I have to say, I can't tell a genuine apart from a fake. Because it's just a QR code, right?
At least from a payment standpoint. So a QR really just allows you to go onto a link. It goes into a website page. That's really the purpose of a QR. It's a quick response to a link on the web. For payments, we have a lot of cryptography on the QR to verify that QR is authentic before the transaction takes place. So within that millisecond, that verification takes place whether this QR is real before the transaction takes place. Even you take out your bank app and you scan a QR that's not real, the transaction will not take place.
Oh, but in this case, the QR code basically brought her to an app.
You can take your camera and scan any QR code.
Right.
And that payment will not be done. But if you use your bank app to scan a QR code for payment, that's where payment is expected to be done.
Right.
And if one of the QR code is not done by us, then there's no cryptography, there's no...
Okay.
And they will not be authenticated and therefore payment will not follow
through. So in her case, had she used a payment platform to scan a QR code,
nothing would have happened.
Yeah. But she basically scanned her camera to go to this website.
Correct.
Which was a
bogus
website.
Same, which is the same of going to any other website that is bogus.
There was a time in the middle of last year when it seemed that the China we're familiar with was a completely different place. When the rest of the world moved on from the COVID-19 pandemic, as many as 300 million Chinese people were under some form of a mandatory lockdown.
There were only two things on my mind, to find food and to not go crazy.
Then suddenly, the people decided to take things into their own hands. For the first time in more than 30 years, protests swept through China. And just like that, zero COVID ended. Join me, Wei Du, for a look back at the extraordinary year in China and hear how it might have changed the country for good. Catch Red Wall Inside China's Zero COVID World, a two-part podcast series by CNA. It's available now on the CNA and Me Listen apps, Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts.
That's the challenge with technology, right? We want it to be convenient, accessible, easily available. So, Mayan, is this a concern, again, with a population that may not be as tech-savvy?
With somebody in my family, my mom having dementia, definitely it's a very, very big concern. I love the fact that we're talking about, for example, voice-activated commands. Yes, it's a bit boring. I want 60 received, etc. But asking those questions, are we inclusive? Having inclusion by design and asking those questions, I think, is a first start in the first instance. And then the second thing is really important, digital literacy. But we've got to understand that, digital literacy is not just for one segment of the population. I think we have to understand, like what Faye said, understanding and educating your staff as well to ensure that they can do inclusion when they speak with customers as well. I believe that that's probably what you have as well in your company.
Yeah, part of the training when you come on board as a staff, actually.
Okay, yes. Okay. But what you do is not standard for everyone, right?
No, it's not. And I think because of our youth, we do and we want to be able to keep up with the trend and not lose out on people who actually prefer digital payments. That's why we actually make the extra effort to kind of educate ourselves on how to recognize a print screen. It could be a screen grab, or if the payment method is false or it's not accepted by the SGQR. These things we know because we use them. We're users, we're right. Young, and we're able to learn more about them in our own time. But my fellow older hawkers, I'm actually the chairman of Amoy's Hawker Association.
Okay.
I do get a lot of feedback from the older hawkers where there have been times they've been scammed.
Yeah.
Not once, but twice by the same customer.
Ooh.
Of about $14 in total. Because she would come and then she would show a screen and we don't have time. Honestly, during a lunch slam, we're like, you pay me, you show me, you take your fish soup, you go.
Right, right.
If someone lingers longer, most times at the back, you'd be like, why is this customer taking so long? You know. So the hawker has no choice but to quickly glance and then give the product that she thought was paid for, but it actually was not. And $14 just gone. And can you imagine if every day she was scammed of $14? It amounts to quite a fair bit. Other than that, sometimes the phone, even though there is voice activation, sometimes the connectivity is not great. They might be connected to wireless SG at the hawker center, which is great, we have. But sometimes if it's not great connectivity, it hangs. So then there's no $2.30 received. Don't have.
Right.
So what happens then? Does the hawker say, I want to see your phone. Can I see your phone? Sometimes the customer gets offended. How do we prevent this? We know because we get the staff to check the phones. We get the staff to see if it's a live screen.
Right.
And most times, unfortunately, if you're exposed to all the payment gateways, every payment receipt screen is different. Some of them are not live. You can't see.
Okay.
Some of them don't even show the actual amount that you pay because there's like cashback or rebates, which is what PayLah actually offers. So for $1.60, if they have a 52-cent discount, it shows $1.08. Sense. And you're like, no, you paid 108 only. The drink is 160. And you say, oh, no, I got cash back. But you've already pushed it away. So these little things actually amount to a lot. And at my store, we have a long queue and we try to clear the queue as fast as possible. So you get your drink, turn over fast, you make more money, you know. But these little things, they add up.
That's sort of like technology working against you, ironically, because there's so many different platforms to want to ride on, offer a discount, you know, and things like that. Actually, if they had just paid you in cash, life would have been a lot simpler, right?
No. In a way. Because the fact that I don't have to give change, I can do a lot of other things. You may not think it's much, but 5 seconds to us is a lot right. of time. And we can do a lot of things in 5 seconds.
Thanks for saying that last part too. I think we're very conscious of two things. One is what we call, again, in the payment space, we call syndicated fraud. Right? If there's syndicated fraud, we are very nervous. Fortunately, maybe in low ticket size, syndicated fraud is much less a possibility because there are many other places for the syndicates to make money. Then how do we prevent in what we call the average Joe fraud? And average Joe fraud can be, as you said, the poor merchant can be frauded on a daily basis by the same guy showing the same screenshot, which is not a real life transaction, right? I wouldn't say we're perfect, as in we've got all the answers, but as we learn, we try to improve. I mean, firstly, we try to teach all our merchants the single source of truth is your own phone, whether you look at it or whether you hear the voice. Totally hear you in terms of sometimes, I think now less, but in the beginning much more, where the reception is no good, my phone is down, I don't know whether it is authenticated, it is transacted. So now we put in a new feature as well. On your own phone, from your app, you can look at your last transactions. Even if it's hanging after a few seconds or a minute, you check, hopefully he's still eating in front of you, you can go and show him you never paid. Again, we try to train our merchants not to look or to ask for the consumer's phone. There's so many apps, very hard to train the merchant to read every app. We're trying to understand all the different average Joe's ways that can scam a merchant.
So, I mean, does it make sense then to have a more or consistent approach where perhaps there is one international standard that a certain sound, a certain screen that whichever payment platform you use will have to show that you have paid, for example?
I think for Singapore, Nets is very fortunate as well because we get majority of the share and we're able to provide this service to our community in Singapore. So it's pretty standard, I would say, in Singapore because we provide mainly for QR acceptance, whether it's called the Heartland Go Digital Initiative.
But Lawrence, I also have to ask you, what happens when payment goes wrong? Either the wrong payment is given or taken. The thing is, very often once it's gone, it's gone. Actually, just like cash, once it's gone, it's usually gone.
Factually, totally right. If you use one of the international payment schemes, there's this concept called chargeback dispute. There are official rules and chargeback rules in place where you can dispute. But even for our QR payments today in Singapore, I think we've read many cases in the press where there's been very successful attempts to get your money back. Whether it is the merchant paying the consumer back because he put the zero, the decimal point in the wrong place, or potentially even the bank giving the money back to the consumer. Even though there are no rules in place that you have the right to dispute a transaction, we have been able to still gain the trust because there hasn't been any case where we...
But in that respect, it is kind of similar to cash. The onus almost relies on the other party who has received it to be honest and to be willing to sort of give back if it was a mistaken amount. Things like that, right? So move on quickly to the future because we have a digital roadmap for Singapore as well. But as Mian highlighted, there are certain pockets or groups that we have seem to have left out. Do you feel in this roadmap that those areas are still neglected?
I do think that there is a lot of ways that we still need to improve on. The one thing which I will continue to harp on is I think we need to continue to ask the questions. I think that we need to continue to demand more from each of us. One thing which I really enjoy about the Singapore policymakers' dilemma is that even though we do have multiple ways of payments, etc., we are constantly always improving. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
When Singapore first started with cashless payments and credit cards, for example, one of the challenges that merchants was facing was my table, not enough space for all of these terminals. Is there a way that we can start to harmonize?
Right.
So we did something about that because after a while, it sort of consolidated and I think very much pushed by the government, pushing. Here's another example, more recent, QR codes. So we talk about QR codes. Mm-hmm. At first, when QR codes came out, I don't know whether you guys remember, 10,000 QR codes everywhere. Yeah. And then after that, MAS said, not sorry, SGQR, because just too many QR codes.
Correct.
So we are actually very much in a process of learning. And I love the fact that we're always constantly improving. We just need to demand that of ourselves and of each other.
Okay. And that should be the way. But are those groups, the vulnerable groups, still left out of the loop?
I do think so. There still isn't a lot of understanding. For example, I didn't know about the voice activation and people aren't switching that on, possibly switching it off because noise pollution. Why every time
maybe,
the orchestra
they turn down the volume.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Can they choose the kind of voice that says $2.60?
We can't choose the voice, but the volume, we actually try to max it out in each device.
Yeah. So we've got different types of vulnerable groups. I've spoken a little bit about people who are deaf, people who have dementia. There's lots of different types of vulnerabilities that exist. We haven't even started talking about infrastructural vulnerabilities,
right.
For example. How are we building a resilient payments ecosystem for everybody?
And in a way, the policymakers may think, well, let me get the system working right first. Then I will start thinking of the alternatives of how to cater to these different vulnerable groups. But at the same time, one would say that technology is the one platform that can be used to really make it more accessible to everyone, including these vulnerable groups. There's a little bit of a chicken and egg going on, and maybe time in that sense will sort itself out.
It is like building the airplane while it's still flying. So definitely that demand is extremely high of each of us. But I think that we're asking the right questions. But to your point about, are there still vulnerable groups being excluded? I'm going to say yes, unfortunately there are. But we are working towards a solution, I think.
With everything the way it is, we all know now that in this day and age, when the internet goes down, when your online banking doesn't work, it's a major, major issue. I mean, the world stands still. In fact, we can all say, sorry, I can't work anymore. There's no Wi-Fi, you know. That's a So, Lawrence, I have to ask you, what happens if one day something like that happens?
From a policy standpoint that MAS tries to lead, there's almost always a backup to make sure that the country doesn't come to a standstill. We invest a lot to definitely not even have to depend on that backup, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of investments to build a trust with both the consumer and the merchant. It's very easy to lose that trust. So I think the amount of investments that we've made from a safety and soundness, a security standpoint, is there today. We do have backups for almost any payments that is required today.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, we need to have a backup for the backup as well, you know. Okay, we just got to wrap things up. We know that technology is here to stay. These platforms are here to stay as well. But if you had the option to change something, to improve or something, or to add something, I mean, what would it be and what would you like to see?
Especially because I'm on the ground and I'm both a merchant as well as I am a consumer and a customer. I deal with both sides of everyday cashless transactions. I do plead for a little bit more understanding, I think both as a customer and as merchants. I think in the beginning, maybe earlier, I might have sounded a little defensive, but I am all for digital payments. Mm-hmm. I do think that everyone, whether it's an old hawker auntie or a young customer, that everyone has that responsibility to do their own digital literacy research, you know, to be informed of how it works, how it should work for both ways, and, you know, just be a little bit more gracious at the point of transaction, whether it could be during a breakdown, like there's no Wi-Fi or what, you know. If there's no Wi-Fi, turn off your Wi-Fi and connect to your own 4G. If there's no 4G, use cash. Don't be insistent on paying by a certain method just because you want that cash back. Sometimes I think you have to look at the bigger picture and think for others, not just for yourself. If that is adopted by everybody, I do think that digital payment would be a lot more of a encouraging thing, less self-suppression.
Right.
So yeah.
So it does sound like it should be one of the tools you use, but not the only one, and be willing to just use other things too. And that's from both the customer and the merchant's point of view, right?
If you have problems, let me help you. If it's really not working, you know, try tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're nice enough, you can come back and pay me for the coffee tomorrow.
We do that. Exactly. No problem. I'm here, you know. 160 is not a big deal.
Yeah.
He's going to chop you tomorrow already.
Yeah, I know.
tomorrow.
Cashless only.
I think for me, as the director of the FairTech Institute, we want to make sure that we're not fatalistic about technology. We're not just head up on the technology. We want to ask ourselves what exactly is fair. And I would say, moving forward with all of our policies, I would like to say, let's look at how fair the policy is being. Are we moving towards fully cashless and just being super focused on the cashless without looking at the fairness of it? I'd say, ask ourselves, what exactly is a fair tech policy that we're going to be moving towards?
Lawrence,
At Nets, we have a purpose statement, and these four words are quite important for us. And our purpose statement is connecting communities, empowering lives. We truly believe that what we do can help make a difference to individuals, empower their lives, sellers, and potentially even connect communities. And now today, even across geographies, not just within Singapore. What we hope to see is what has been said so far is not so much the means, but really the end. So how can we use technology to help us reach that end? And really our focus of really trying to connect people, connect communities, empower lives is really what we hope to be able to do with digital payments.
So it really sounds like, you know, while there are many things working for us on these digital platforms, there are also some things that still need a bit of work. And I guess that is an evolving process that will continue to take place all the time. But I also wonder if it's a concern just for the here and now, because I'm thinking about it, when my kids are all grown up, 20 years from now, actually, this could be the norm for them. They won't struggle with using these platforms because they've grown up using it. There will definitely be fewer bank branches, small payment platforms, and most certainly far less cash in the system. I also recall a story of how about 5-6 years ago, my mother-in-law, who is now in her 90s, had no idea what WhatsApp is, right? Well, we're so glad we taught her prior to the pandemic because she became the most prolific sender of messages and photos and, you know, and thanks to her grandchildren who taught her how to use it. So I think we got to look at it that way. If someone you see at the shop doesn't know how to use the app, take them aside, help them for a few minutes. It's not too much to ask. Maybe you get a e-ang pao in return once they figure out how to do it. But thank you all for coming in. And for all of you listening in, we hope you've enjoyed the discussion. As usual, if you've got any feedback, do send it our way. You can always jump onto my social media platforms and drop me a note. Or you can email us at cnapodcasts@mediacorp.com.sg. The CNA Podcast team comprises Jacqueline Chan, Joanne Chan, Tiffany Ang, Saya Win, and Crispina Robert. Till next time, this is Stephen saying, keep talking, keep connecting.